Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I am your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm joined by Chris Hutting. Let's get into the first news story of today, and we're going to be talking about something a little bit different from our usual fare, and this is about many of South Africa's clashing rights: the right to privacy, the right to trade and work in conditions that you and your employer agree upon, and the role of labor courts in disputing all of this. So we're looking at a case here where a woman was fired from Barloworld Equipment, which she worked for. She was earning about 40,000 rand a month. And she was fired because she kept testing positive for cannabis in various mandated company drug tests. Now, the company has a zero tolerance approach. They suspended her from work the first couple of times. She continued to smoke the drug, and so she was eventually fired because of this. She took this to the labor court. The labor court agreed with Barloworld. They said, you know, it's fine to have a zero tolerance policy. That's a condition of employment. And so, since you tested positive, it doesn't count. She appealed this decision, and the labor appeal court has found in her favor, saying that she was unfairly dismissed because the policy was, quote, overbroad. And they said that this zero tolerance policy should not apply to people who are not working heavy machinery. So you can imagine a company like Barloworld Equipment, they are making some, you know, heavy equipment and stuff like that, which definitely, if you have any kind of substance in you, you might pose a danger to yourself and others. But this particular woman was in fact a office worker, and so the argument seems to have been made by the court here that her right to privacy had been violated, and that by the company's own admission, this had not been in fact affecting her work, that they had fired her purely because that was the policy and the policy needed to be followed through with. This also raises a sort of broader question, which is that, you know, South Africa has been in this awkward state. We've had some regulations regarding marijuana, I think, passed through Parliament. I think it was last year. But marijuana remains in this sort of slightly gray space that seems to kind of be inexorably heading for full legalization. We're now at the point where you have shops and things selling marijuana pretty openly in some places. There's a lot of blurring of the line between sort of non-THC products, THC being the active ingredient that tends to be banned. So sort of things like CBD oil and stuff are being sold all over the place. And some of these actually don't comply with the regulations. So it's a bit of a kind of a mess. But I think this is an interesting one because of what it says about you know, various rights in our society being in tension with each other, as I said at the beginning. Chris, what do you make of this story? It's quite an interesting one. I'm not quite sure where I fall on it. I do see it sort of from both sides. The company does have a right to set the conditions of employment, but at the same time, you know, if I'm doing weird things at home, when this isn't that weird, a lot of people, and this woman says she was smoking marijuana to ease pain from, I think, joint pain it was. And it's not affecting my work. I don't really see the issue. What do you make of this?
Yeah, I guess it's not to extrapolate too far, but you run into this with many corporates when they say, well, it's a letter of the law, so we have to enforce it, but there's nothing around the wider context. So whether that's them enforcing something on their own employees or whether it's them engaging with certain macro government policies or legislation, they'll say, well, this is what's written down, so we have to engage with it, but we can't take it on a case-by-case basis. We can't see how we can implement it in a way that suits us, our work culture, what works for our employees to make sure that they are the most productive that they can be, but also that they have sort of, I guess, wider peace of mind. If you know, in my personal view, if you're going to want to have particularly productive employees, you need to make their general relationship with their employer, with their workplace, I guess, as collegial and sort of win-win as possible and not so pernicious and nitpicky and all that kind of thing. So it's interesting how it what it indicates of this particular company, but also what one can do as a company, as an employer, with certain laws and regulations and how you implement them, whatever your personal views might be, what's best for your company, what's best for your employees, et cetera, et cetera. There's the wider discussion around sort of individual liberty. If you're consuming something in the privacy of your own home that doesn't harm anyone else, if other people are, for example, smoking with you, if it's all voluntary, consensual, and it's adults, you know, above, let's say 18 for sort of arbitrary argument's sake, then why would anyone else need to be involved? Where's the burden, I guess, in terms of sort of that harm principle? Where is harm being caused to someone that the government or a business would need to step in? So I think it's going to be interesting to see how this develops over the coming years. And as you rightly point out, how it's a bit of a limbo space at the moment, this sort of enforcement of cannabis regulations and laws, and how the contestation will manifest, and inevitably where the incentives going to be. So how much tax can government take, et cetera, et cetera. How will that inform how lax regulations are or not?
So just to clarify as to what the law currently says, the most recently passed law, I actually didn't realize that it only passed through the NCOP in February of this year. But essentially, it allows people to privately possess relatively small amounts of marijuana, as well as to grow plants and to smoke it in a private place. It puts heavy restrictions on smoking in a public place. And it also still prohibits the sale of marijuana, which is definitely going on all over the place. Sometimes even as I said, in some like brick and mortar shops, you can actually find it in some areas. And the fact that in certain places, the government is, I believe in the Eastern Cape, supporting marijuana growers for exporting the product to other places in the world, but not allowing it to be sold in the country. I think while our marijuana legislation is definitely better, because I am in favor of legalization, is better than it was a few years ago, it's still in this bizarre sort of limbo space that doesn't make a lot of sense. Anyway, let's move on to our next topic. And this is about the South African Reserve Bank Governor, Lesego Kanyako, who has said that South Africa is growing extremely slowly despite some increased output. And he says that this is due to structural problems holding the country back. According to the South African Reserve Bank, South Africa's economic growth is going to average just over 1% over the next 2 years. It's a very low amount, likely to be less than population growth. In other words, we will be coming on average per person poorer over the next 2 years. But that's not unusual. We've been going poorer per person for at least the last 10 years. I see, once again, the SARB is playing that important role of being a sort of respected neutral institution that is being fairly blunt about the difficult economic place we're in. One of the things, of course, talked about here is the effect that electricity shortages have had on the economy. South African Reserve Bank estimates that electricity shortages took at least 1.5 percentage points off of GDP last year, although it expects this to reduce in the coming couple of years. Chris, what do you make of this?
I think it's important what you highlighted there around a neutral institution. And the Reserve Bank governor, Lesego Kanyako, more so than other sort of colleagues, especially those on the Monetary Policy Committee of the SARB, that's the committee that regularly meets and decides whether interest rates will be cut, kept the same, or increased. But Kanyako has a track record of speaking out, I think, given on whatever platforms he might find himself, private functions, public functions, et cetera, et cetera. I agree with his comments. If you don't have reliable electricity supply, if your goods and materials can't move easily through your ports and cross your railways, you're going to have low to no economic growth. What does that mean? That means that people's average quality of life declines over time. If you can't generate new investment, run out of space and support for new businesses to start up, you might also then over time have the concentration of the economy where those bigger companies that can deal with these extra costs that are imposed, they're fine and they continue to make some sort of profit, but there's just so little room for new entrants. And then you'll get the DTIC and others coming in and saying, oh, there aren't new market entrants. What can we do for subsidies and localization? But if you don't fix the basic infrastructure issues, then I think you can do all the sort of industrial policy you want. And it ultimately will just lead to more concentration of various markets and sectors. One thing, and it's not to say that the Reserve Bank governor's argument is weaker for this. Again, as you mentioned, the sort of the neutrality of the institution, maybe it wouldn't be good coming from it. But talking about macro policy things, so things like preferential procurement, the cost that that imposes on state-owned entities, making their operations just much more costly than they should be, cater deployment and the difficulty there for the for private sector, public sector companies, but also private sector companies in their dealings with the state, who gets put onto certain boards, who gets control of what. You've got talk of reform now at entities like Transnet. Can that actually happen if ultimately this policy and this philosophy of cater deployment still persists? So you can tinker at the margins, I feel like, and that's not to say you can't make progress with things like the unbundling of Eskom or getting now, for example, a private sector player at the port of Cape Town, as has now been mooted in the past week by Transnet to get private sector investment at the port of Cape Town. That will help in the short term, but I don't know if it resolves those structural issues that the Reserve Bank governor highlights. It keeps those things, I think, still channel contracts, funds, all that sort of thing to those who are the most politically connected and doesn't benefit the wider economy. It doesn't build, I think, a more resilient, adaptable, really vigorous economy over the long term.
Exactly. Okay, let's talk very quickly about a couple of by-elections that have been hosted around the country yesterday. There were quite a few of them. I'm not going to go through all the results of all of them. The kind of upshot is the Patriotic Alliance, the PA, had some very good results. The DA had mixed results, some good, some bad. The ANC had mostly bad results, although in Limpopo, it did actually strengthen a bit. And MK Party and Action SA attempting to expand their reach outside of their cause, in the case of Action SA Gauteng, in the case of MK KwaZulu-Natal, they were both competing in a Limpopo by-election. They did pretty poorly. So the sort of highlight ones here are a Ward 1 from the DA by the PA, where the DA last election got 45%. They went down to 39%. The PA managed to consolidate pretty much all the opposition to the DA, growing from 3% to 40% and managing to just by 28 votes snatch this ward from the DA. In another ward in Cedarburg on the West Coast, Cedarburg First, Cedarburg Easter, managed to fend off a Patriotic Alliance attack, mostly at the expense of the ANC. So the ANC in the previous election got 40%. The DA got... The Cedarburg First got 35% and the PA got 7%. This time the ANC went all the way down to 23%. Cedarburg First went up to 39% and the PA went to 36%. And the DA didn't stand there because I believe they're in alliance with the Cedarburg First in that municipality. Another bad result for the ANC is in the Garden Route, where the ANC held a ward with 46% of the vote, and the PA shot up from getting 1% of the vote, mostly benefiting from votes that used to go to an independent candidate, to surge to 65% of the vote, the ANC dropping to 32% of the vote. So in that ward, the ANC took another beating. The DA had a good result in the Blue Crane route in the Eastern Cape, in the Sarah Bartman district municipality, where by 98 votes, the DA managed to take a highly contested ward from the ANC. The DA grew its vote from 44% to 52%, whereas the ANC shrunk from 54% to 47%. So by-elections are not a perfect example of how things are going to be in the coming election, because they are driven by so many different factors, often local things, the quality of the local candidates, the quality of the previous councillor, all sorts of stuff like that. So it's very difficult to kind of draw national things from this. But it does seem as though the PA is continuing to firmly sort of entrench itself in South Africa's colored communities, and that the ANC is in a bit of trouble. Also, MK competing Limpopo, very poor result. Not unexpected, I think, but it does confirm, I think, that MK's appeal is mostly confined to KZN. What do you make of this, Chris?
Yeah, I think I'm in agreement with those points, especially maybe the strong position in which this could place the PA after the elections, depending on what it wants to get from the ANC in the Western Cape. So if it was willing to go into coalition with the ANC there, what does it give in terms of support, but also what does it demand? If that then over time helps the ANC bring down at least what the DA gets, to help the ANC in that particular province, where, I mean, for years, the DA has just increased its share of the vote and the ANC has continued to decline. So this could be one way, I think, a sort of little bit of an opening there for the ANC. I'm not sure from their side whether they'll be willing to work with the PA in the Western Cape. I guess time will tell. But I wonder about that sort of kingmaker role, if you want to put it that way, that it will place the PA in. Otherwise, yeah, I agreed on MK, what this indicates about their national footprint. I'm sure that the focus always was on KZN as sort of first prize. I mean, some polls now showing that four or five parties are polling now between 20 and 25% in KZN. So if you thought it was already going to be hotly contested, I think that's going to be the case moving forward. But yeah, for MK itself, there isn't real clarity around long-term strategies and long-term vision. So is it happy to sort of build a strong base in KZN and then build out from there? Or does it want to make more of an impact across various provinces? Which, if that doesn't happen, does that accelerate infighting, which is already being reported? And surprise, surprise, the sort of people who are involved. I mean, you know, I hope that doesn't surprise anyone. So,
yeah, just to talk a little bit about the ANC. The ANC has definitely suffered in a lot of these by-elections, particularly in KZN, but also in the Western Cape and also in other places in the country. Now we're also seeing parts of the Eastern Cape. Or, however, I think generally speaking, the by-elections have also suggested that in the Eastern Cape and in Limpopo, the ANC is going to remain fairly strong and, in fact, maybe even solidifying some of its control in Limpopo, perhaps even at the expense of the EFF, it remains to be seen. This result in Ward 10 in Polokwane might be an indication of that kind of thing, where the EFF actually previously won the ward. Action SA got 10%, the ANC got 43%, and the EFF got 47%. This time, Action SA went down to 2%. MK only managed 1%. The EFF got 43%. The ANC got 53%, managing to win the ward. So while the national trend is definitely against the ANC, there are still a couple of places where the ANC remains very strong. And that's one of the reasons why it will almost certainly continue to be the biggest party in the country, definitely at least until the next election, and maybe even beyond then. But that's, I think, far too far in the future for us to get too excited about or too interested in at the moment. So let us simply close it for today and say we hope you enjoyed the show, and that's a wrap. The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR, or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.